Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hey, good morning, everybody. My name is James Barra. I'm the Vice President of Software Development and Nearshore Operations for Curity, based in Miami Gardens in Miami. And for the past 20 years, I have been in software development, everything from QA tester to developer, software dev manager, all hats, all sorts. I think that's kind of the nature of software, of just fixing problems where you find them.
That's super exciting, James. Thanks so much for making time to join us on Ivy Podcast. Before we go on and talk about all the great stuff you're building at Curity, maybe give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Yeah, sure thing. So started off in software dev when I was still in university at Georgia Tech. I was actually an intern at Google quite some time ago, so I was blessed to have the opportunity to work there. Through there, I found out I enjoyed kind of solving problems, and I have found that kind of people are the most complicated engineering challenge there is. So my career has grown from, you know, QA to developer to dev manager to tech lead. Not necessarily in the order that most people would think it would be. At some point, I was a dev manager and I wanted to get back into tech, so I went back to a tech lead. But ultimately, I came back down the path of leading teams. Worked at Amazon for a little bit, working on some of their AI integration in their mechanical warehousing. I've had the wonderful opportunity to work all over the world, Switzerland and Zurich and Kyoto and Japan, Bay Area, Washington, Bellevue, all those types of things. So very happy and very blessed to be able to have worked with a lot of people over a number of big companies in my career. And now recently I have found myself coming back to a smaller company with Curity because I'm proud of the mission. I'm proud of what Curity is doing and making IT health software to better the lives of seniors, are kind of our most neediest population. And we are creating software right now that's going to give them better quality of care with VIP service. So taking my lifetime of experience and putting it towards a worthy cause is something that makes me happy and challenged every day.
That's very exciting. And thanks for sharing that very diverse background and having worked in, you know, in technology and software engineering. It definitely resonates on so many levels. And I have, you know, there's quite a few areas I want to dive into. But before we do that, maybe tell us a little bit more about what Curity does. What are you currently building within the organization? Maybe an overview of what the company is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. So Curity is a wholly owned company by the ChenMed family of companies. So ChenMed is a value-based care company in South Florida who has been doing amazing value-based care for now 25 plus years and one of the only profitable players in the industry right now. It's all privately and family owned. Curity is their technical arm of it. And what we are doing is we are taking the current platforms that have been created inside of our centers and creating them in a SaaS model so that we can distribute them. And not just for sale, but the idea is we're trying to propagate the idea of value-based care. So we want to even be able to sell this to our competitors for them to be more profitable so we can actually change healthcare. So a couple examples of what we're doing. We have a number of different brands and our brands are specific to the actual population. So we've got, you know, Dedicated, we have Chen Senior, we have Gen Care. We have a new brand we've launched called Intune Health, which brings our value brand to a lower age demographic. So previously we've worked with seniors and the idea is because we want to give care to our neediest populations. But recently we have found that our methodology works so well that folks who are in their 30s and 40s are wanting to actually take advantage of this as well to become even healthier earlier in their life. So we launched a brand called Intune Health. And Intune Health is kind of the very same thing that we do with our other brands, but it's very virtual forward. Folks who love applications, love working with things over their phone, virtual visits, all types of things, whether it's going to be on the phone, via some device, whether in person, or a blend of all those things for better overall health, right? So my teams right now, we have a number of different applications that spread across all the brands, but ultimately the bread and butter is how do we automate care at the clinic? How do we automate billing? How do we make sure that if there are medications that they show up for the right people? How do we give our doctors, our care coordinators, and the patients the data that they need to live longer, better, happier, healthier lives?
Yeah, that's super exciting, and thank you for sharing that. And having spent, you know, your career in organizations of different size, and you mentioned on a global scale, from technology to software innovation, can you share a little bit more insight into some of the trends and maybe some of the insights that you personally follow that you're very excited about, whether that's in telehealth, maybe in healthcare in general, or just overall technology trends? Just curious to get your perspective on some of the, you know, insights that you're personally very passionate about.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you three. And obviously one of them is why we're here on this podcast today. And I'll mention that one last. So really the first one is empowerment for the developers. As technology changes, as we can do more, you're bringing more and more closer to the developer. Whereas organizations used to be huge and you'd have a dev org, a QA org, a build and release org, a compliance org, all those things. What's happening is we're getting good guidelines and good standards and good automation, and we're getting it smaller and smaller. So it's more empowered and closer to the developer so you can go faster, right? As a developer, nothing frustrates you more to build some code and have it sit on the shelf somewhere. And as a leader, nothing frustrates me more than when my developer says, yeah, it'll be 3 weeks because it takes me 1 day to develop and two weeks and 6 days to actually get it approved through the process. So the more we bring closer to the developer, the faster they're empowered to run their own destiny and the more accountable for and responsible they are for their own success. So that's number one. Number two is just the amazing amount of automation tools that we have out there today, right? If you're doing something manually, you need to ask yourself why that is, right? Now, not everything should and can be automated, but there are many things that if you take advantage of automation can save you a lot of time. Ultimately, I have found for a dev team, the most precious asset is time, right? When you talk about code coverage or something else, right? All those things are a derivative of time. Like sometimes you don't have a lot of time before release, and what do you skip? Do you skip QA? Do you skip these things? But if you can truly manage your tools to make time your fastest asset, you can choose to release fast, slow, on whatever cadence you need to, and bring value in a way that's going to be time appropriate. So the automation tools are fantastic, and there's so many great examples in the market out there. I will say that my favorite plug for one of them is Sonar. If you're not using Sonar for your QA testing and those types of things, it's an easy win. It's an easy setup. And then lastly, a trend that I'm looking forward to and we're going to talk about more today is globalization of skills and nearshore development and labor. So for the past probably, 12 or 13 years or so, I have been really dedicated in founding, training, teaching, onboarding, and then hyper-ramping software development teams in other countries. And let me kind of tell you why that is, and I'll break through a few definitions, and then John, I'll let you ask me a few more questions. But as we continue to virtual this world and more things can be done with great conversations like this, we find ourselves saying, let's look for the best talent, not just talent that's sitting here, or not just talent that I can move to me, right? There's a lot to be said about having co-located talent, and we can talk about some of those things as we dive deep, but you could have co-located talent in a different location that gives you access to a different talent pool with different hiring constraints and speeds, with different run rates and speeds, with different skill sets. So as an executive, what I think about is I have this much time in a year. Here's what I want to deliver value on, and here's the budget roughly that I have to do these things, right? I'm going to say, how can I look at my workforce from a total world capacity, and how do I align my organization to be productive, right? With certain areas at certain times, at certain run rates and certain speeds to get the maximum value. Now, please realize I didn't say cheapest cost. A lot of folks think, hey, James, if you move, to different operations in, for example, LATAM or in Asia or something, you're just going for lowest cost. That's not what I said, right? Because very often these offices can be potentially more expensive than certain areas in the United States. What I did say is to drive maximum value. So we'll dive into that. But overall, I'm super excited to see that those nearshore expansion spots that we can talk about later have really been growing some great talent. It allows for some great culture blending across the company, and it really gives companies a multifaceted view. So as opposed to just being a single location, you could be many locations that blends many cultures. They truly add strength to an organization.
Yeah, that's super exciting, especially it's timely to what we're currently dealing with coming out of pandemic, and a lot of executives, most of whom are subscribers to, listeners of the Ivy podcast. And the reason that they do subscribe is because they want to hear the practical recommendations and strategies from fellow, you know, executives at organizations of various size. And the one of the topics that keeps coming up, especially lately, is, you know, structuring your workforce, whether that's from a fully remote or going into some type of a hybrid setup, hybrid environment. And also when you add another layer of complexity, also tapping into the nearshore markets. What are some of your initial thoughts when it comes to building that culture of, you know, innovation, that culture of experimentation, where you're not necessarily co-located, but you also now bringing into another, you know, team, maybe that's, you know, not onshore, maybe nearshore. Maybe share some thoughts from a standpoint of just, you know, initial ingredients that you need to look for when it comes to just building that culture of innovation.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're an executive and you're out there listening, let me ask you a question. When you're asking folks to return to the office, are you doing it for them or are you doing it for you? So one of the things that people need to consider is that when they're driving the culture of a company, the culture of the company does not come from the folks who are in charge. The culture of a company comes from everybody who's at the company. Now, tone and expectation and core values, obviously that's done by the board and the executives, and hopefully everyone aligns to those. But culture is not those things, right? Culture is one aspect of your organization, and culture is everyone. So I'm going to give a kind of a edge case example that will help demonstrate this. If you are a company who is 100% in person and you went into the pandemic and everyone had to be remote and you're coming back and your entire company is struggling and saying, why do we have to come back to the office? We're productive. Ask yourself, why do you think people are struggling, right? Why do you think that your company is struggling in this way, right? Are you doing it for them? Or are you doing it for you? Do you have the expectation that folks will be more performant in the office? Do you have the expectation or the assumption that the culture will be better in the office? And sometimes, by the way, the answer might be yes, right? There are some industries that are super amenable to being in person, some that are amenable to being virtual. But that doesn't mean you have to be one or the other. My advice to executives who are listening out there when it comes to something like this, this is not going to go away. And as the industry continues to evolve in different ways, what I suggest you do is evaluate your options and find out what it is you're willing to pay for your choice, right? If your choice is truly in person, then you have to realize you might get lower quality talent at a higher cost. And if that's what you want, that's okay. I'm not saying you will, but I'm just saying your talent pool shrinks from the folks who both live there and want to move there. Right. If you embrace a hybrid option, right, of coming to the office some days and being virtual some days, ask yourself, what's the value in that? What are you getting for that? Now, nearshore is an interesting proposition. And let me quickly define three things, right? So staff augmentation, nearshore, and offshore. And I think these things, there's a stigma around this. So let's just elephant in the room and talk about it right now. Staff augmentation is when you hire a company, whether it be contractors, wherever they're located at, to do a job for you at a certain cost, right? So I own a software company. I have got database A, I have database B. I'm going to hire you for $300 to migrate database A to database B. All you're viewed to me is as capacity. You're like a battery. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, so I give you a great example of how all of us do this in our normal lives. Most of us don't care about our natural gas provider. We just need natural gas, right? There's nothing wrong with a relationship that is a utility. So when you're talking about staff augmentation, that is a utility relationship. It has nothing to do with core values. It's, did you move database A to database B? There's a lot of that out there. And there's nothing wrong with using those things. The next is offshore. Here's how James personally defines offshore. Offshore resources are resources that are not based in your home country, that are usually six or more hours away from your time zone. And let me kind of tell you why I quantify that. When you get to be more than 6 hours away from your base of operating time zone, it's very difficult to work on the same time zone that your company standardized in. You have to have different processes because you're working at night. You have to have handoff processes. And generally, not always, but generally when you're more than 6 hours away, the country is far enough that there are cultural norms and differences that are very significant. So you have to have interaction points differences. You have to have cultural respectiveness, all those things to be important for offshore. A great example of offshore is that if I had an office based in Miami, Florida, and I wanted to work in Mumbai, India, or if I wanted to work in Cambodia, or if I wanted to work in other countries, that is such a large time difference and change that we'd have to have fundamental changes to our practice to support those extra people in our organization. Right. Now, some folks do staff capacity and offshore, where they hire somebody and they're kind of quote contractors, where they kind of treat them like a contractor and try to treat them like a statement of work. It's an interesting blend of those things. And lastly, let me talk about nearshore. Nearshore is when you're usually within 2 or 3 hours, so less than six, right? So if you're in the United States, for example, everything from the coast of Florida all the way to California just draws a stripe down the world. So you're basically including all of Central America and all of South America, so all the LATAM states. Now, it can be a little bit interesting if you have folks in Brazil and you have folks who are in Monterrey, Mexico, because that's like a stretchy time difference with daylight savings. Sometimes it's 4 hours, sometimes it's six. However, just think of it, United States, Central America, South America. Central and South America have very similar cultures in a lot of respects with respect to cultural norms, office days, holidays. Every country is unique and beautiful and different. So you have to learn those things. But ultimately, when it comes down to James being nearshore, I say my nearshore definition is, could I fly to you in one day? Could I be there and support you if I needed to within one day, right? In Miami, I can get to anywhere in South America within the day. If I wanted to go to Asia, it might take me 3 days to get there. So nearshore operations are folks who are waking up in your same time zone, plus or minus, folks who attend your working sessions, plus or minus. And the biggest pivotal difference between nearshore and offshore is nearshores are simply treated as employees who don't work for you, right? When I open up nearshore offices, they get the same benefits that my employees get with slight variations based off country. They're not treated like, hey, this is a person in the Costa Rica office. This is a person in the Sao Paulo office or Brazil. We respect them like that, but they're treated just like employees who live somewhere else. So they are both in person because they go to the office there, but their office is represented virtually. So if you're an executive who's listening earlier, when I talked about embrace the change, nearshore is both a combination of being in person when those folks will come to the office, but they're not in your office. They're hybridly and they're virtually represented. So that's an interesting new angle if you haven't thought about it. It's you have an actual physical presence in another location where folks are virtually being presented to you. And that's just your company growing in size and growing in complexity and depth.
I love the comparison that you drew between the offshore and nearshore, because there's oftentimes misconceptions when it comes to offshore opportunities and the different, you know, actually where the teams are located. Where do you see the most opportunity when it comes to nearshore, especially, you know, we're talking in the context of technical talent, of software engineering, and yes, both of us are located on the East Coast of the United States, and you've mentioned that kind of the downstream view going into LATAM. Which countries in particular do you see great growth, maybe exceptional talent when it comes to also availability, to the extent that you can share that those insights? Just maybe tell us where is the most activity is at these days.
Yeah, absolutely. So that the short answer is it's complicated, right? And the longer answer is this. It depends upon what type of skills you're looking for, how long you're looking for them, and why you're looking for them, right? So I'll give you a great example. There are many countries who have unbelievable talent, but if their infrastructure is not necessarily set up correctly and due to their laws, it may be very difficult to have a base of operations there. So there are a lot of countries right now that are super growing and their university systems are fantastic. But once folks graduate, it's very difficult to have a true point of presence that will be practically valuable. And this is a random example, but let's just say in Chile, right? Let's say, you know, a great university in Chile, but people can't afford to live in university forever, so they move back, but the infrastructure is not great. Doesn't matter how smart the person is, it's very difficult to have them as a remote resource and a nearshore resource. Now, if you're thinking about opening in Chile and you say, hey, James said bad infrastructure, that's just a hypothetical example here. So let me talk to you about what I've actually seen that's been practical, and a few skill sets that are helpful, and how I came about to getting that information. So the first is, and kind of my favorite actually, is Colombia. I'm actually wearing their shirt today, which by pure happenstance. It is a very developing country in a lot of ways with respect to culture and tradition. And it's a beautiful country in that nature of people work very hard and dedicated. They have a number of great universities that are putting out people in back-end languages and front-end languages and UX and product. So all those aspects, and specifically in Colombia right now, in Medellin, Medellin is their nickname, is kind of the Silicon Valley of South America, right? So tons of major tech companies down there, Rappi's down there, LATAM Airlines is down there, Avianca, like all the major tech companies that are based out of South America have huge points of presence. In addition to people like Amazon and Microsoft and HP and Intel, like one of the world's largest Intel factories is actually not in the United States or nor in Asia, it's actually in the LATAM space. But ultimately, when you think about, you have to ask yourself like talent-wise. So Medellin is my favorite inside of Colombia, but Colombia is a great place to work. Other places like Costa Rica and San Jose is a very popular place. It has been for about 10 years. The talent is exceptionally talented in that space, but it's super competitive, right? So if you don't have a foothold in that space, it tends to be hard because you're competing with folks like Microsoft, you're competing with folks like Facebook, you're competing with folks like Amazon. And moving into a new space, folks think, hey, I want to work for a US-based company with great benefits. This person pays X dollars, this person pays X plus $2, right? And the benefits are different. So you have to ask yourself, like, you know, how big do I want to go into a certain country? Brazil, there's a lot of talented folks in Brazil. The pipeline's great. The infrastructure is fantastic. There are so many countries that have opportunity there. What you really need to do is find yourself a trusted partner, right? And you know, a plug for the IB podcast. I've been working with my base pay for a long time. And a lot of you probably are familiar with them. They have some great recommendations on where you can find talent. But let me tell you this. What you should never do is just pick one person to tell you what to do, right? What you should do as an executive, go out there and attempt to find good data and find a good data that potentially supports a position. But just because one country is the cheapest doesn't mean it drives the most value, right? So you should segment your organization and say, why is it we're doing this? Why is it we want to go nearshore, right? And I'll tell you, a lot of folks want to go nearshore because it's very hard to hire in the US. It's very hard if you have 60 developer recs, and you want to hire 60 developers. My guess, and you think of your head real quick, how long it would take you to hire 60 developers. My guess is that number is over 3 months or 4 months, right? It would take you over 4 months to hire 60 solid developers, especially if you're wrestling them to come to the office every day, especially if you wrestle them to be hybrid. Whereas in nearshore, an average nearshore event, I can spin up about 30 developers who are super, super solid in about 2.5 weeks. And that's just because the pure availability of resources in other countries and the fact that we're willing to pay a premium, right? Like the goal of nearshore is not about lowest cost. The goal of nearshore is realizing value. And actually, in general, the reason that we're able to be successful in nearshore is that we'll come and pay a higher rate than other employers there. So we get employees and not even employees, that's a bad word to say. We get members of our family who come down there and who will work for us and be dedicated to us and who we take care of and who are part of our culture and part of our teams and part of our company. And we're good to them, right? And it's a great opportunity for them. It's a great opportunity for their community because we invest back in the community. And for us, it's a great opportunity to seize time as our greatest resource and asset and take advantage and really truly create value in the time that we have.
Are you at all concerned or maybe talk to us a little bit more? What do you prepare for as the next kind of that next phase? Because you've mentioned a lot of huge companies, a lot of growth in these nearshore countries. And so, you know, yes, availability is there and perhaps certain points of affordability in some of the tech talent. But with a lot of companies moving in that direction and that trend picking up steam and growing more and more with, you know, year over year, at some point we're going to hit a plateau and where you're going to see, you know, also the scarcity of the talent and perhaps the salaries and the rates are not as competitive as what they used to. Just what are your thoughts from that perspective? What are you thinking? What are you preparing for?
Yeah, and that's a great question and just something just to address head on, right? I'll give you a couple examples of where that's happened before. I'll give you an example of where it's happening today, and I'll give you an example of what will happen in the future and why that is. So if you look at the country of Panama, right, the national currency of Panama is the US dollar. And because the US dollar has become the standard down there since the Panama Canal, what happens is the majority of pricing is in US dollars. So even if you look at the country of Panama, which is right next door, right in the LATAM space, the cost is very high because cost of living is very high because of laws, right? Ultimately, as executives, all of us are to the mercy of the laws of wherever we operate and do business. So knowing that when you expand in nearshore, whatever country it is, you're going to have to become a semi-legal expert in all things that are legal and all things that are cultural, because otherwise it will bite you and bite you difficult, right? So Panama today, if you hire developers in Panama, often a lot of developers in Panama will want more than developers here in the United States, right? You're like, wow, hey, what do you mean? I you're charging a California Bay Area salary and you're based in Panama. And because some of the cost of living there might be difficult. So that's said and done. That's been there for a long time. Now, there are some great resources in Panama, and I'm not trying to make a blanket statement. But what I am saying is my experience has been when I've kind of developed from Panama, I'm usually looking at somebody in the Bay Area at the same time because their prices might be the exact same thing. Now, a country who's on the way to doing that, right? So Costa Rica, my company Curity, we have at this point 38 or 39 resources in Costa Rica. Love Costa Rica, love San Jose. It's very competitive. So as I mentioned to you, the office we're at right now, less than a 5-minute drive, I can get to the Intel plant, I can get to a Microsoft office, I can get to an HP office, Amazon, all those things. And what happens is when there's great talent, you get folks who want to come in and work with great talent. And that inherently will create competition, right? When you have competition, you have to either raise your benefits or give people incentives and motivations to want to stay with you. So we've done a little bit of both, right? Over my time there in Costa Rica, with, you know, Curity being Curity, we have a very compelling and driving mission to change healthcare. Now it's for a different country. So my folks in Costa Rica are thinking like, hey, we're making a difference, but for somewhere else. So we're trying to tie that back to, you know, what's important for them and how can we make changes for them and how can we potentially take what we're doing and apply it in great spaces to help people of Costa Rica at some point in the future. There's no promises, but we're trying to do those things and we're doing them in earnest. That's number one. Number two is that, and to be frank, we pay more, right? So we pay more for a resource there. It's significantly more telling as opposed to saying, hey, we're going to value your time, your contribution, and we'll genuinely compensate you fairly. A lot of folks go nearshore because they're looking to pay the least and get the highest value. And in my opinion, yes, you might pay the least and you might get good value, but if your employees are not dedicated, if they're not passionate, if they're not caring, you're not going to get full potential. And even if you get full capacity, that doesn't mean full potential. Full capacity is the amount of work somebody can do over a period of time. Full potential is who they could become or what they could do over a period of time, which are two very different things, right? So if people don't love what they do, they'll work for the check. If people love what they do and who they work with, they'll come to work, but they're enjoying it and they're going to make it better because it's their place. It's their home. It's their family. So we pay a bit more and we provide an amazing environment with a beautiful office with some great amenities. And I visit the team once a month. I'll take the team out and say, hey, how are you doing? I work with my nearshore resources, just like with my onshore resources. And I want to see, like, what can we do to make this better for you? And it's not always money. Most of the time, folks aren't asking for more money. They're saying like, hey, can we come in an hour later? Can we have this day off, right? It's about being human in that sense. So that's currently happening in Costa Rica, and that's okay. We're going to flex that market, and I'm going to love and continue to invest there. Lastly, I'll give you an example where it's wide open space right now. So I mentioned Medellin in Colombia, that's kind of the Silicon Valley. There's unbelievable amounts of talent right there. And there are companies who are just now starting to invest in that space, whether it be in Medellin, in Bogota, in Cartagena, in Cali, in numerous locations in Colombia. You can find amazing talent for a very cost-effective rate for folks who are passionate, caring, and dedicated. I've had 0% turnover in my offices since I've started there. And the reason why is because I treat them like people. And you find folks more on the more junior end of the scale. So that's another question, John, you asked me earlier, like, where should I look for talent and what kind of talent? It depends on what type of team you want to make. If you want a team of all experts, of all A players, of all 100% people who can work on their own, no supervision, no nothing, you better hire folks in the United States. Like, that's what you're looking to get, because you're going to pay for it. If you're looking for folks who are more junior, who you can grow a career, who will be more loyal, but need more handholding and coaching, LATAM is an excellent opportunity to take a team that's junior and build them in a course of 6 months or 9 months into a very, very high performing team for a very, very cost effective rate. So Medellin, Colombia is great in that sense. Bogota is not short after, but it rains every day there. And I'm a huge fan of the rain. So that's why I pick with the sunshine.
So to bring it all together, if I'm an executive or of, you know, a software development IT organization, and I'm looking to explore options, diversify and go the nearshore route, What are some of the initial steps that I am undertaking in order to make sure that this entire program is, you know, part of the overall company vision? It's not just a tiny experiment, but at the same time, I set myself up for success from the very beginning. What types of partnerships should I form? How would I structure the initial first hires? Maybe talk a little bit further about those initial steps that you would take if you were starting all over again.
Yeah, sure thing. So the first thing before you do any of those, I would ask yourself why it is you're doing what you're doing, right? So with respect to nearshore, your staffing in general, right? You have a need somewhere, right? And you ask after yourself, like, why it is I'm doing what I'm doing. And there's going to be drivers behind that need, right? Some of it might be to make money. Some of it might be to fix a gap you have. Some of it might be to reduce costs. Whatever that is, ask yourself your driver, right? And if your driver is going to be something that is time sensitive, right, then you could consider nearshore. And the reason I say time sensitive, again, is because hiring is difficult. Like hiring quality talent in a fast period of time can be challenging in the United States. And I don't envy recruiters because you have 800 recruiters sometimes for two candidates. And it's like a, hey, who's going to give the most and who's going to flex the most? And you're so worried about talent attrition. So if you have a time box and you have a serious need, then I'd consider some nearshore. And then how do you get started with that? The short answer is you should ask somebody who's done it well and then copy them, right? I believe in this, the core value of Amazon, which is steal shamelessly and give credit where credit's due. So I worked at Amazon for a long time. And I'll tell you, if somebody has a good idea, you don't have to go out there and think about like, how do I have a new good idea that's different? Ask them, how did you do it, right? How did you make that wheel? And then say, will you teach me? There are a lot of companies out there who will happily sit down with you and say, hey, I'll give you 15 minutes of my time for a beer. And I'll walk you through what we do, right? So the first thing is get some information. And that does not mean go to 15 consultants' websites and say like, who's operating in what countries? That doesn't count, right? Talk to folks who have done it before and say, what did you do and what do you regret doing? Get your information first. Second, if you say, you know what? Okay, I talked to three or four guys and ladies and I think this might be a good idea. Go with a trusted partner, right? If you don't have base of operations somewhere, that's like picking a random country for vacation and hoping to show up and just do business there. It's going to be tough, right? So find out somebody who's done it first and get yourself a good engagement. Now, I've got a number of strategic partners. I think I've mentioned one. I've used My Base Pay before, and I've worked with many partners in the past, and I hope to work with many partners in the future. My goal is to find the best at doing what I want to do and then learn it, right? So I've been doing nearshore now for 12, 13, 14, 15 years. And I'm still learning something new every day. And then maybe I'll do it on my own at one point. But I find for me, if I leverage folks who already have good connections with HR and payroll, who already know the legal understanding of those countries, who already understand how to operate and incorporate in those spaces, that's one less lower bar of entry I have to pay, right? So understanding and finding a trusted partner. And then lastly, is running an experiment, right? But an experiment doesn't mean low cost investment, right? It doesn't say, let me just hire two people and quote, see how it works. Right? Because I truly believe that you're going to get out of something what you put into it, right? You've heard this 100 times in 100 ways. You get what you pay for, right? And you're going to get back what you invest into. So if you just pick two random people in a country and say, look, let me hire them and give them no love and attention, no onboarding, like no welcoming them to a family, they're going to be a battery for you. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, let me be clear. Let's go back. There are times when you want to engage somebody to pay them to move database A to database B, right? Like, that's okay. I'm paying you for a solid amount of work. You do it in 15 seconds or 15 hours, you still get $10, whatever that is. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, again, we all want our natural gas from somewhere for our house, and that's what you pay for. That's what you get. But nearshore is not that. Nearshore is an investment into another person who will be an employee, whether they're your direct employee or whether they're through a third party in a different country. Right, that's how you have to have the mental lens of somebody who's there. And it's going to be difficult, right? Which means you probably need to get your butt or somebody else's butt on a plane to go and hire them and meet them and understand those needs. So it's a steep investment to start with. That's your time, not necessarily money, right? But like investing your time and effort into training, coaching, and growing those spaces will yield significantly. So let me recap that for you, John, because I know I said a lot here. If you're going to try something new in the space, don't pretend to invent it and be the best. Now, you might come up with something that's the best later, but look around and see who's done it and see who you admire and ask questions. find somebody who's done it before and say, hey, what did you learn? And what, you know, what can I do better? And then even better, ask for their help. Say, hey, do you have people there? Can you help me out? As an executive, I'll tell you, I don't ask for help often enough, and I should, right? That's one of the things I've found over my career is I've got connections in a lot of places, and I should call somebody and say, hey, you know what? I have a really solid hire in this in the Sao Paulo region, and I really can't meet him, but I need you to do me a solid. I need you to go ahead and take the guy out for dinner tonight and actually understand who this person is. Tell me, give me the cultural value of this person. And because I know you, you can tell them all about me and tell them all about me and see if we're a potential good fit, right? Like, ask your friends, ask your peers for help in those spaces. You never know if they're going to say yes for you, right? And then lastly, don't be afraid of initial low results. When it comes to New Year's short teams, I'll tell you, they're an investment. You should not do, this is again, this is James's personal opinion. New Year's short teams are not meant for 3-month projects. When you have a 3-month project of moving database A to database B, you hire staff augmentation. You say, look, I've got a super hard time box. I got to move database A to database B. The requirements are set. You hire somebody to do that, right? And there are plenty of firms who will help you do that in many different countries. Nearshore teams generally tend to be less productive in the first 3 months because they're younger, they're more junior, like we mentioned. You have to train them, you have to onboard them, you have to get them equipment, all of those things to get them going, integrated into your culture and your company. Now, notice I didn't just say to get the work done. I didn't even mention the work in that statement. I said to get them integrated into your culture and your company. They also are going to be doing work, but keep in mind your resources over here who are doing work are teaching them. So productivity on this side is going to go up a little bit, but it'll go down significantly here. So you're actually usually paying more and you're getting less productivity in the first 3 months. However, what happens is that is going to come this way. And this nearshore bucket will get 75, 80% as productive as your onshore people. And they're going to cost you potentially half as much. That's where the true value of nearshore comes in, when you have folks on 3, 6, 9, 12, even more. The longer you keep a nearshore resource, obviously you're going to grow their salary just like everybody else, but your return will be significantly higher over time, right? So that's why I'd say, think about it. If it's a long time boxed investment that you want to change your company culture and grow it and evolve it in a lot of ways, and you're willing to ask for help, that's a great first starting place.
That's great intel, Jameson. Thank you for sharing that. And to bring this home, maybe from a different lens of a perspective, you've unpacked a lot of the advantages, a lot of the strategy, a lot of the initial steps that you could potentially take to explore, you know, going into nearshore routes. But maybe talk a little bit more about the lessons learned through this journey, maybe through the recent engagements. So what are some of the things that you have learned? Maybe you would have done differently. Maybe some of the potential risks that you should pay attention to, and essentially just unpack a little bit more from the disadvantage side to some of the things that you should plan for that may not be so obvious at the very beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I had mentioned, I've been doing nearshore for a long time, and I've if there's a roadblock or a speed bump, I've hit them, right? And it's not a journey for the weak of heart, but I will tell you, it's evolved me as a leader probably more than anything else I've ever done, because it's forced me to understand perspective. And I believe perspective is the most powerful teacher you can have. So let's talk about a couple of the challenges. The first one is every country has their own government, and governments change their minds a whole lot. And when you're starting to deal with 2, 3, 4, 5 governments, it's very interesting to have to keep abreast of what's going on, who's being elected to policy and whatnot. So understanding is, as you diversify, it adds a layer of complexity. At some of my previous lives, we had nearshore operations in 10, 12 countries. And I would spend hours every week being like, hey, what's the new political thing going on? What's the new HR rules? What's this? And that's tough. If you manage those on your own, that's tough. Right? Making sure that you have a trusted partner to kind of run those operations for you I tried to go in and do it myself initially, and it's painful. Now, it's worth it, right? But like, I quite frankly didn't have the time. And if it was wrong, it was my butt on the line there. So I moved to a partner to say, like, if you're already licensed to that company, you already know these things, like, I'm paying you for your expertise. So thinking you can do it on your own, I mean, you probably can. I'm not going to say you can't, but I'm going to say that I've been doing it for a long time. And unless you're planning on hiring 20,000 employees or even 5,000 employees, don't even put that thing in your mind right now. Like, start with a partner who can help you out. And then a proper partner, by the way, will have a agreed upon exit strategy, right? So I've got a partner today, I'm not going to name drop here, again, but if I've got solid resources in certain countries after a certain period of time in our agreement, I'm allowed to convert them to full-time employees. So it's kind of a great try to buy, and that partner will help me establish in those spaces. So I mentioned before, don't go it alone. That's the first one. So like laws are a big stopper. The second pitfall here that you should look out for is that if you're not willing to invest, and let me reiterate, invest doesn't mean a bunch of money. If you're not willing to invest time and effort and energy, don't do it, right? It's not the right reason, because if you just want to hire somebody to move database A to database B, just go hire somebody to move them, right? It's going to save you time. I mentioned I see all my nearshore people once a month in person, and that's a time investment, right? Having to get on a plane and go to these offices, having to do one-on-ones with my team. Like some people ask me, like, James, why do you have one-on-ones with your contractors? And they say, well, they're not contractors, they're my nearshore team, right? They're like, well, yeah, but they don't work for you. And I said, yeah, they do. They just don't work in, you know, for me properly as far as payroll and whatnot, but they're part of the family. And the only reason they are is because I'm not licensed to do business there yet. Like, so you have to have the mentality of, are you looking to grow your business, or are you looking to time and invest? And if you had a leader and you said just because their paycheck was coming from somebody else, you wouldn't coach or train them, that's not the mentality you should have here. Because the more you invest there, the more you're going to get back. So be willing to travel. Be willing to actually go and do what's needed. Be willing to celebrate tons of other holidays you didn't know existed, right? Because just like Thanksgiving is important for us, right? You know, there are other holidays in other countries that are equally as important that have value. And being culturally respectful has grown me a lot in my career and understanding. And then last is going to be understanding potential versus ability, right? This is where I think a lot of executives fail when they say, look, hey, I have a VP position open right now, and I want to get a candidate who's from Harvard Business and X, Y, and Z, and who's had 15 years of experience, right? There are times where you need an A player who can just run, right? The more executive you get, the more you need somebody who can come in and do the job right away. And that does exist in the LATAM spaces for nearshore, but super limited. Just like the US market is super limited for good executives, it's going to be even more limited outside of the world, right? But when we start going to positions that are more hands-on, more technical, more software specific, ask yourself, do I need 15 people who can run right away? Or am I okay hiring two people who can run right away and have them train the other 13? So potential is looking at somebody and seeing what they will be or could be in 3 to 6 months. Ability is what they can do today, right? So if I'm looking at 15, if I've got 15 open recs for React developers, right? And I see a bunch of resumes and there's three people in the interview who are like, look, James, I don't know React. Which is leads me to a little side story. And I'll tell you about how I actually interview almost everybody in nearshore, which is absolutely not scalable. I just love doing it. So I'll get back to it. But if I'm interviewing three people who don't even know React, it has happened to get to me in front of me, but they're a good culture fit. They're strong technically in Angular. They've done tons of other stuff. And I asked them, how quickly could you learn React, right? I'm like, well, maybe it might take me 2 weeks. I have to think in my head, right? Like, hey, I could not hire somebody, or I could wait and hire somebody else, but this person has all what I'm looking for except that little piece. Like, do I see the ability in them, the potential in them to run and grow and do this thing? So when you hire for nearshore, you should be hiring for a good combination of straight raw talent, but more so ability, right? If you're willing to invest, right? And that's the mistake I think most people will make. They're going to be like, James, I want 15 solid candidates who are all full stack developers who can do everything out of the gate day one. And I'm like, congratulations, go to Southern California. You'll get exactly what you're looking for, right? And they're like, well, yeah, but my budget is 1/10 of that. And I'm like, well, so here's the secret. Go, invest, teach, coach, understand when people fail, support when they may fail, celebrate when they win, and grow a team. Because a good farm team, and I'll quote Pat Riley here, a good, small, nimble team can run circles around a big team. And that has a lot to do with passion, investment, time, and feeding from the coach, right? If you're going to, when we want to coach somebody, that's the last piece. You got to be ready to invest there. And I'm not talking about dollars. I'm talking about everything but dollars.
Oh, absolutely, James. You've been very generous with the insights, the information you shared with us today, which definitely begs for a part two of this, which we've discussed. We're going to plan an executive roundtable webinar event, more specifically with some case studies and practical, evaluation of how to do certain things when it comes to nearshore. So for all of our listeners, just definitely look out for the announcements. And event postings from that perspective, probably in the first part of next year. James, I can't thank you enough for your time today. I personally learned quite a bit. And like with majority of the guests on the Ivy podcast, what I love doing is actually follow-up recording in about a year, where we revisit the conversation from a year ago and see if everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm hoping it'll still be the same. I hope that I can come back with a few more lessons learned. The only thing I can guarantee you is I'll be more handsome in a year. How about that? Everything else is subject to chance.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.